This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with one of the filmmakers of the new documentary, Who Bombed Judy Berry?
The FBI accused Judy Berry and Earth First of bombing themselves. Who Bombed Judy Berry is a recently released documentary about the car bombing of labor and environmental organizer Judy Berry. Judy Berry was a natural... Berry was a leader who rallied thousands of activists to camp out and protest the clear-cutting of redwood forests during the timber wars in the 1990s. Though Judy was crippled and in chronic pain from the car bomb, she went on to sue the authorities. She sued the FBI and the Oakland police for First Amendment and civil rights violations. The jury was out for 16 days and came back with a verdict of over $4.5 million. The case was tried by a heroic band of National Lawyers Guild attorneys. Judy's colleague, Daryl Cherney, who was in the car when it was bombed, is a film producer, and he joins us to talk about his new film.
Welcome, Daryl, to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's great to be here.
You've produced a wonderful film, Who Bombed Judy Berry, and we wanted to start, just for listeners who may not know about Judy, by asking you to give a short update of who she was and then also why she became so dangerous to corporations.
Judy Berry was a union organizer and an Earth First organizer. She was the mother of two children, a professional carpenter, a fiddler, and a magnificent orator, a grassroots organizer extraordinaire here in the Redwood region of Northern California. She worked in her last, 10 years or so to protect ancient redwood trees as well as to unionize sawmill workers, and she did so simultaneously. And that, in a way, is what made her so dangerous to the status quo. Because in a world that we know so well as divided and conquered by, those who would have us fighting each other rather than those at the top, Judy Berry was a unifier. She was somebody who brought loggers, timber workers, mill workers, truck drivers together with environmentalists to find our common goals, our common ground, which is most of what we believe and stand for, and to focus attention rather on the corporate elites who are manipulating all of us. And she was able to do that in a way that I don't think has ever been done before.
Can you briefly describe what the issues were listeners may not know about Earth First, and then lead us through sort of the scenario of the bombing, and then we want to ask you specific questions about that?
Yes, well, the issues are the same today as if you allow, they've been for the last 6,000 years of recorded history. Human beings have been logging the forest since the cedars of Lebanon right up to the present day, and Judy was taking on the issue of the mowing down of ancient redwood trees that stand 350 feet tall, 15 feet wide, 2,000 years of age. And so these trees, give all of us who live here, and it is where I live here in Humboldt County, California, a sense of awe, a sense of something being larger than ourselves, as well as having great ecological value and great, scientific and historical value. A single redwood can hold 4,000 gallons of water. They're also worth about $50,000 a piece. And so you can see that the money in the redwood business is pretty large, but probably today 98% of them have been cut down. There's some of the second and third growth have come back up, but they are nowhere near the kind of forest. There's no comparison. It's like, comparing an infant to an adult. There's just no comparison as to what's going on.
Daryl, let me just ask, the time frame that we're talking about, just so that people know, sort of happened in the 80s and 90s, right?
That is correct. Certainly, these issues still continue today. But yes, Judy Berry was, and Earth First was in its heyday, in her heyday, probably late 1980s through the mid 1990s.
Judy organized what was called Redwood Summer, and it was kind of based on Mississippi Summer back in 1963 when people went down south to help with the registration of workers. But Redwood Summer was something else. Talk to us about what Redwood Summer was and who the bad guys were and what they were trying to accomplish.
Well, Redwood Summer did emulate and imitate a Freedom Summer, sometimes called Mississippi Summer, down in the Deep South. And the strategy was the same, that as long as things happened in the Deep South without anybody else looking, they could continue. Jim Crow could continue. The lynchings could continue. And in the Redwoods, the mowing down of our ecosystem, which we believe is as much a civil rights movement as it is an environmental movement, because our ability to live on this planet depends on our ecosystem staying intact, that was going to continue on as long as nobody else was watching. And so just like in Freedom Summer, we invited college kids and anybody else who wanted to come to participate. And that is what Redwood Summer was.
Daryl, since you were there, we'd like to hear sort of the personal account of, I understand that through protests and fights against corporate cutting down of the trees, there were threats made against you and Judy. How did that feel? How did this lead up to the actual bombing? And were there other incidents that made you fearful?
Yes. We received probably about 36 death threats, mostly by letter, but some by phone and some even in person, over a very short period of time, about a month and a half, right after we announced Redwood Summer. So starting in April of 1990 through the time that we were car bombed in May of 1990. And we kept all these threats in folders. We turned them into the police. I even called the FBI itself at one point. So this was something that was known in the newspapers and known to law enforcement. So Judy and I were really tense. I was scared not just for myself, but I was more scared for Judy because she was a person that I loved dearly, and I couldn't really imagine the world without her. And so we decided to do a tour to actually get out of Dodge because we mistakenly assumed that the threats were mostly going to be the most dangerous in our local areas, in the rural logging areas of Humboldt and Mendocino counties. So as we were touring universities, Santa Cruz, Cal State Sacramento, I could give you a laundry list of the colleges on our schedule. As we were leaving Oakland, where Judy had spent the night, heading towards Santa Cruz about just before 12 noon, I got into her car, and may I say that there were two cars I could have ridden in that day. I was a passenger at that particular moment. So I chose to get, or Judy ordered me into her car. So it was sort of a happenstance, a twist of fate, if you will, that I got into Judy Barry's passenger seat. As we drove for literally just a couple of minutes, if not, or less, a bomb exploded under her seat, almost killing her, fracturing her pelvis, causing intestinal damage, pulverizing her lower vertebrae. She was really almost killed. And by some miracle, I was only slightly injured sitting right next to her and the bomb. It was a big, 2.5 foot long, foot and a half wide hole through the sheet metal floorboard. And I would say instantly, really just within 5 minutes, the FBI and Oakland Police showed up, but the FBI in particular, and announced that we were terrorists who were guilty of having our own bomb explode on us. May I say that they knew immediately that the bomb was a booby trap. It had a motion trigger designed to only go off in a moving car. They looked at the death threats and immediately dismissed them as irrelevant. They, right at the beginning, decided, as our lawsuit against the FBI said, that Dennis Cunningham, National Lawyers Guild of the Year attorney, at one point wrote, he said it was just the FBI was around the corner holding their ears.
Judy made it a point of having all the people she organized come to Redwood Summer take a pledge of nonviolence. Why was that?
Well, a number of reasons. One, you can't bring thousands of people to mass actions and have a bunch of wingnuts or just violent people show up, haphazardly and disrupt things for everybody else. I say that violence is a dominant gene. You can have, 1,000 peaceful people, but one violent person can ruin it for everybody else. And so we as organizers took a firm stance, and I really recommend this for a lot of other mass organizing groups, to institute a nonviolence code right off the bat. Now, Earth First did have a history of advocating sabotage in defense of the environment. In our movie, there's somebody who says, well, destruction of equipment may be wrong, but destruction of the environment is equally as wrong. And so the Earth First movement added a whole new spice, a new flavor, and at the time, we became the darlings of the media by becoming the living incarnation of the Monkey Wrench Gang. Now, it wasn't as if we were personally, or anybody we knew, was sabotaging equipment, but certainly it was in the newspaper, it was in the songs we wrote and sang, it was on the t-shirts we wore. You could say that we were modern-day Luddites who just had disdain for the machinery of destruction. So that was another reason to call for the nonviolence code, to make sure people understood that this was not an invitation for the Monkey Wrench Gang to show up.
Now, when you and Judy were accused by the FBI, as you say, just minutes after the bombing, of having planted the bomb, I don't know if we want to give away everything that happens in the film, because it gets really interesting with what the FBI did and did not make public, which goes to the lawsuits. Were you surprised that the FBI accused you?
Well, I was shocked, but in the end not surprised. I was actually reading at that particular time Ward Churchill's Agents of Repression, which gave a whole comprehensive history of the FBI's counterintelligence program, their COINTELPRO program. So as soon as they accused me, really, just very shortly after the bombing, they just said, look, we can tell if this is your bomb, so why don't you just confess, make it easy on all of us, and get it over with. As soon as they said that, I immediately thought of Leonard Peltier. I thought of Geronimo Pratt Gijaga. I thought of all the people, the Puerto Rican independence movement. I thought of all the people that I had just read about, which is why education in the environmental, actually in the activist movement, is so important, so we understand that history does have a tendency to repeat itself. So, no, I wasn't surprised, but I was shocked, and I was pissed. And I let them know it, and I, of course, as soon as they said that, the first thing I said was, I want to see my lawyer.
That's the first thing everybody should say. Frank Doyle, the FBI agent who was involved in COINTELPRO stuff prior to that, particularly with Geronimo Pratt, what role did he play in this disaster?
Well, you know, first we have to say that it was Richard Held, who was a famous, you know, or infamous COINTELPRO operative. He and his father, there was a Richard Held Sr. and a Jr., they were both worked under J. Edgar Hoover, and they specialized in disrupting political movements. In particular, Richard Held, who was in charge of the San Francisco Bureau, which was in charge of our case, personally saw to it that Geronimo Pratt was put into prison ultimately for 27 years on false charges before he was ultimately freed and given $4 million by the FBI for false imprisonment. So there's the same guy in charge of Pratt's case, the same guy who led the manhunt for Leonard Peltier across the Canadian border, the same guy who was in charge of our case. So it was a political operative. Now, Frank Doyle was working under him as the chief of the terrorism division in San Francisco, and he taught a bomb school every year, I do believe. And in this particular bomb school, it took place in Humboldt County. The FBI rented land from the Louisiana Pacific. And the more I learned, the more I realized that the FBI had an ongoing relationship, certainly beyond just renting land from the lumber company, but they rented the lumber company land to blow up cars with pipe bombs as part of a police academy course that was offered at College of the Redwoods. So here they are blowing up cars with pipe bombs, putting the bombs on the inside of the car. If the bomb is on the inside of the car, then the occupants must be guilty. So they essentially recreated the bomb scene just 30 days teaching bomb school with Frank Doyle before it happened. And then when the bomb went off, there's Frank Doyle with one of his students, and he points at the car on FBI video, his own voice, and he says, this is the final exam.
You remind us of also the false memo that was later found out to be issued by the FBI on Earth First letterhead. Can you talk about that briefly?
Well, I certainly want to issue blame where it's due, and those false press releases were ultimately issued by a lumber company, for lack of a better word, interest group. They were not issued by the FBI, although those people in the lumber company certainly worked happily with the FBI, but they were actually people working in the lumber industry. And it was a woman whose DNA we actually got off of one of the fake press releases, named Candy Boak of Boak Logging. That's a proven fact. Who was involved along with some other people in sending out these fake press releases. But what they did, the press releases said we were violent, and they were distributed in lumber companies' sawmills, in the laundromats, so that there were, and none of us saw them until eventually one filtered down to us through the press. So those were definitely part of a hate campaign, definitely designed to take a very, very tense situation and really pour gasoline on the embers and blow the whole thing up.
Heidi had mentioned the lawsuit, which was quite an extraordinary achievement. We wanted to talk to you about that. What was the FBI and the Oakland police accused of doing, and what happened as a consequence of the lawsuit?
Well, the FBI and the Oakland police ultimately were found liable, which is a civil term for guilty. So they were found guilty of violating the First Amendment of the Constitution, and that was pretty much the primary charge, and that was that they knew we were innocent. It wasn't that they were mistaken. It was that they absolutely knew that we were innocent. I mean, they found the motion trigger that said the bomb can only go off in a moving vehicle. They said nails in the bomb matched nails in the back of Judy's car. Well, Judy was a carpenter, but the nails in the back of her car were roofing nails, and the nails strapped to the bomb were finishing nails. They were no more identical than a Rolls Royce and a Volkswagen are identical just because they're cars. So you've got them lying, and the jury is listening to these lies. They never conducted any investigation at all. They didn't take, even in our case, even if they wanted to prove we were guilty, they never asked Judy a single question, and they could have questioned her any time. We both stepped forward with our attorneys and said we will be happy to meet with the FBI or Oakland police I wanted to file a police report that somebody tried to kill us. That didn't seem to be an option. So right to the day of her death, the FBI and Oakland police never asked Judy Barry one question, even though they could have taken her deposition because we sued them. They could have taken her deposition as early as a year after the bombing. They never had any interest, and when she finally gave her deposition on her deathbed, they did not have any questions for her. We were Dennis Cunningham, our attorney, was the only person who had questions. However, they did, and this is not in the movie, object to Judy's answers approximately 350 times. Yes, we counted. 350 times in order to disrupt her from being able to answer the questions that our own attorney was asking her, because they didn't want the jury to hear Judy Barry speak eloquently and fluently.
Can you clarify when they were objecting? Was that when Dennis was taking the deposition? She was in the hospital room, or she was. We should let listeners know she was dying of cancer.
Yes, our movie is framed Who Bombed Judy Barry, which, by the way, people can see on whobombedjudybarry.com. Who Bombed Judy Barry is framed around Judy Barry's deathbed deposition because she was not going to live to see our civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and Oakland police. She's not going to live to see it to trial. She had to give her testimony on camera, and we take that on-camera testimony and allow her to narrate her own story. Who Bombed Judy Barry is narrated by Judy Barry. And so what we don't show in the movie, because it just wasn't either interesting or it didn't make for a good movie, but people should know, the FBI interrupted her at every juncture. You know, who was in the car with you? Well, the answer is Gerald Cherney. But that calls for speculation, you know? Yeah. They didn't allow, I'm surprised they didn't object when she gave her name. You know, they objected to every single thing she said.
That's extraordinary. We didn't know that from watching the movie, because it was edited out, because she just does a wonderful job, as weak as she was, kind of laying back on that couch, a wonderful job of describing what kind of political organization she had created and what they accomplished and how she was framed up for trying to exercise her First Amendment rights in organizing against these powerful corporations. Just an extraordinary movie, Daryl. Really, we congratulate you for having the fortitude to do this. Talk some more, will you, about Judy Barry. You know, we all knew about her living in New York, but we weren't ever present at any of her talks or what she was organizing, because we were a continent away. But she emerges as one of the great heroines in the American left from this movie. Talk to us more about her, would you?
Judy Barry spoke in plain language, but she issued profound thoughts. And I think that one of Judy Barry's special abilities was to be able to speak to the working class, of which she was a member. Judy Barry was a working carpenter, a full-time carpenter. In fact, she called herself a foreman. She was a foreman at California Yurts, and she supervised the construction crew. So Judy Barry was no stranger to hard work, to working with wood, no less. So she related to the logger. She was able to say things like, she would say, well, a logger may make the first cut, and a mill worker might make the second cut, but the person who publishes the Earth First Journal is making the third cut. You know, she totally drew the line. She said the greenhouse effect will give us wonderful weather to watch the end of the world by. She was just she had a great sense of humor, and she was the kind of person who just spoke to the every person. And when she spoke, thousands came to hear her. She motivated people. She was also a great organizer. I mean, she kept the mailing list. She did the fundraising. She sat at the T-shirt table. She got, arrested in doing civil disobedience. She organized the largest mass arrest in the Forest Movement's history. I think only one anti-nuclear movement had more arrests in a single day. There was 1,033 arrested. She got Bonnie Raitt and other celebrities, Ed Begley Jr., to come and join us. but mostly she had a radio show on two radio stations, as a matter of fact, up here in Mendocino and Humboldt. So I think Judy Barry's strongest attribute was her oratory. I call her our Martin Luther King of the Redwoods.
And she played the violin, and I will never forget that scene where you're making a presentation, I think, with officials in a sort of stuffed shirt room, and she brings out the violin, and people just stare. It was quite beautiful.
Darrell, yes. How can people see the film and say it slowly and repeat it?
Well, our schedule is on whobombedjudybarry.com. That's JUDIBARI.com. We're actually doing a one-week benefit for Pacifica and KPFK in Los Angeles December 7th through 13 at the NoHo 7 Theater in North Hollywood. That's all on our schedule. And we'll be back at the Long Island Film Festival in the New York area around the end of February, beginning of March. Again, just go to our schedule at whobombedjudybarry.com.
Thank you, Darrell, and you have all our support.
Best of luck to you, Darrell.
Great job, Darrell. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.